This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Carolyn Quinn, and thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour for Sunday, the 8th of October. The conference season is drawing to a close. The SNP and the Greens get underway this weekend, but it's memories of that speech at the Tory conference that will live on for some time yet. Theresa May's supporters are out in droves, trying their best to clip the wings of any circling vulture called Grant, or Boris, perhaps. Discussing leaders, parties and the challenging agenda facing MPs as they return to Westminster, my guests are former Cabinet Minister Stephen Crabb, Labour's frontbench business spokesman Jack Dromey and the SNP's Kirsty Blackman, the party's deputy leader at Westminster. BuzzFeed's Jim Waterson provides our expert look ahead to the political week, and we'll be discussing whether or not MPs and peers should leave the Palace of Westminster altogether to allow a massive refurbishment programme to take place. The government's delaying having a vote on whether to spend the billions of pounds that would be required. I wonder why. And Chris Mullin, with his author's hat on, imagines how the establishment might react to a left-wing Labour government. The House of Commons tomorrow will be full of MPs returning after the party conference season. And what a few weeks it's been, with Labour's confidence soaring and the Tories, give or take a few plotters, trying to rally round their wounded leader. At least that's what they say in public. Theresa May has given us a flavour of the domestic policies that she wants to push through, but those questions about her own future persist. And of course, underlying everything, those Brexit negotiations and the ticking clock on progress. With me for the next hour then, Stephen Crabb, MP for Presley Pembrokeshire, a former Secretary of State for Wales and then Work and Pensions. He left government last year when Theresa May became Prime Minister, and after his own failed crack at the leadership. Well, you're possibly a bit relieved about that, Stephen, seeing what she's going through at the moment.
Well, we knew at the time we had the best person to do the job as Prime Minister, and she's still the best person.
Well, we will talk about her more, obviously, through the programme. Jack Dromey sits on the Labour front bench as Shadow Business Minister. He's MP for Birmingham Erdington, I do apologise, and a former trade union official. And on a human level, Jack, did you feel for Theresa May last Wednesday?
On a human level, yes, I did. It would be inhuman not to have felt for her. Having said all of that, I feel more for the country than I do for Theresa May.
More later. And joining our happy crew as well tonight is Kirsty Blackman, who represents Aberdeen North and is SNP Deputy Leader at Westminster. Kirsty joins us from our studio in Glasgow, where the SNP is currently holding its party conference, and your leader makes her speech on Tuesday. We'll talk about that, Kirsty, but first of all, commiserations about the World Cup bid.
I know, I'm devastated. The mood of conference has gone flat for the evening, but I'm sure it'll be up again tomorrow.
That chap in the news sounded very down, didn't he?
And no wonder. This is always what happens to Scotland. We're always just close enough that you can almost taste it and then it just disappears.
Oh, well, look, there's always another chance, I suppose. Unlike for Theresa May possibly to make another conference speech, because, my goodness, she had a very difficult time last week and she may have seen off any immediate attempt to oust her after that wounding end to the party conference, a conference which was designed to show she was bold and in control and back on track tackling the kind of burning injustices that she targeted when she first became Prime Minister. But the danger hasn't gone away. The longer-term threat by no means has been eliminated. The Prime Minister remains vulnerable. She's come under pressure to bring new faces into her top team in an effort to revitalise her administration. So should she get rid of her key irritant, the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson? That's what the former Deputy Prime Minister Lord Heseltine had to say on Radio 4's The World This Weekend.
If she wants to assert her authority, she would have to sack him. But, of course, it's a high-risk policy because he'll be on the back benches and he won't go quietly. I think Mrs. May has a real, almost insoluble problem because she's got a deeply divided cabinet, a deeply divided country, a deeply divided party, and she's got Brexit, which is going to cast increasing shadows over the next couple of years as the saga of negotiation unfolds. That's her problem. But, how can a government survive with that sort of dialogue in the background?
Well, his former boss, Sir John Major, knows what it's like to be in a back-me-or-sack-me position. He used a Mail on Sunday article to call for a more radical social justice agenda and said the party risked the neo-Marxist Jeremy Corbyn taking power if it didn't unite. But friends and colleagues of Mrs. May have been piling in to support her, despite newspaper reports that cabinet ministers were among those discussing the need to replace her. Culture Secretary Karen Bradley said Mrs. May would absolutely still be in place at Christmas, and Scottish Tory leader Ruth Davidson was equally supportive when she spoke to Robert Peston on ITV.
This is about who's the best person to run the country. I think she's the best Prime Minister that we've got. And, you know, she has my full support if she chooses. And, you know, I've spoken a bit this weekend of I'm actually getting a bit narked, and I'm sure there's quite a lot of women out there that are getting a bit narked at how many male commentators are talking about male cabinet ministers deciding what she should or shouldn't do as if she has no agency in this herself. God damn it, she's the Prime Minister of a G7 country. You know, she didn't get there by luck or by default. She has got grit, determination, dignity. She believes in service and diligence, and she absolutely has my support.
Well, Jim Waterson, politics editor of the BuzzFeed News website, you're here to look ahead to this week. But this week will be overshadowed by last week, won't it?
Last week, and also the Labour Party conference, which was, if you went to the two, you'd have thought that one was the excitable one that was going into government and one was the one that was in a sort of opposition and wondering what to do with itself. Conservative Party conference had a bizarre tone, which was of a party that felt like it had lost, even though it had just snuck into power again, with another 5 years to go if it wants, and with the Prime Minister of its party. Instead, they were, most MPs I kept encountering seem to be wandering around saying things like, how on earth are we ever going to get young people back on board? What are we going to do about Theresa May? And when's the Prime Minister going to go and who's going to replace her?
Well, looking ahead, Stephen Crabb, do you think Theresa May can survive post-Christmas? She's living on borrowed time?
Absolutely. How long she continues will be a decision that she makes. There's no conceivable reason why she doesn't lead this government right through the whole term of this Parliament, if that's what she chooses to do. I think people...
Is it in her gift, though?
It is in her gift. I think people are exaggerating, first of all, the importance of party conferences. And I don't actually think that any of the events that happened at either our conference or the Labour conference over the last few weeks has really moved the dial of public opinion. Actually, I think those people who tuned in and saw what the Prime Minister went through on that awful day where everything seemed to go wrong around her, none of it was actually her fault. Actually, there was a lot of admiration and respect for the very human way that she responded. So, you know, I don't buy this theory that somehow we're starting this new session of Parliament now tomorrow with the Prime Minister in any more of a difficult position.
But already weakened, because she wanted that conference week to show that she was bold, that she was stepping forward, that she was in charge. And everything seemed to go wrong, didn't it? There was a feeling of a vacuum almost at the conference that was filled at times by words from Boris Johnson. And then... Everything else was rather flat.
Well, two things. Actually, if you look at the substance of what the government were announcing during the course of conference week, there were some really, really important issues that were being brought to the fore, like the need to invest more in social housing, council housing, the need to address inequalities in our mental health provision. And so the substance was sound. But, you know, as I said, I think people tend to exaggerate the importance of these conference seasons. And I think the best thing that we can do as a government and as a party is actually just get on with the business.
And reshuffle Boris Johnson. Do you think he needs to go? Because he has been undermining her authority.
So on the issue of reshuffles, you know it's a natural part and parcel of what party leaders do. They refresh the team, they create career pathways for talent coming through. And my goodness, we've got an incredibly talented young crop of MPs on our backbenches through the 2015 and 2017 intakes. But she shouldn't do it under external pressure. She should do it at a time of her choosing, when the moment is right for her. As for the question of Boris that you asked me, you know, he's a pretty formidable player. You want all of your best players on the pitch at the same time playing together as a team. And I think that's the overwhelming desire of party activists and the MPs I speak to. They want to see the government working together with a unity of purpose and really getting to grips with the challenges, the very serious challenges that face the country.
Kirsty Blackman, for you, obviously, you're opposing the government on many occasions. Do you feel that it would be more helpful to you to have Boris Johnson continuing in the cabinet or outside?
I think If you look at what's happening with Brexit, there are very few certainties coming out from the government. The only thing that seems certain is that we're stuck with Boris Johnson on the front bench of the Tory party. I think, you know, Theresa May almost refused to describe him as unsackable, and we're kind of stuck with him. And actually, my concern is that what the government seems to be doing is what's good for the government and what's good for the Tory party, rather than what's good for the country. I don't think anybody would look at Boris Johnson and think he's the best person we could possibly have as Foreign Secretary, because he's just not.
Jack Dromey, you were saying that on a human level, you felt for Theresa May. And as Stephen said, I mean, none of those things that happened on Wednesday were necessarily her fault.
At a time like this, a defining moment in our country's history, you need a Prime Minister who commands respect, a united cabinet, and a government with a vision, both economic and also where does the country go post-Brexit. What we've got is the reverse. We've got a Prime Minister who's not up to it, Boris Johnson, who's an absolute disgrace to our country. We've got a cabinet at war, and a Conservative Party deeply divided. Question where that goes next, because what's clear, and this is where I disagree with Stephen, is when he says that the Labour conference didn't necessarily shift things. I think what we're seeing is a fundamental shift in the country. The country, Stephen, has just grown tired of semi-permanent pay restraint and falling living standards. The country's grown tired of the degradation of public services. The attempt made by the Conservatives at their conference were timid measures, stumbling in the right direction, but nowhere near the scale of vision and commitment necessary.
Do you know what, Jack, though? I've got quite a long memory now. I've been around quite a few years, and I remember worst weeks ever for various Labour prime ministers. I mean, you remember the cash for peerages saga, Gordon Brown's worst ever week came around regularly. There were plots against him. And I mean, only recently you yourself stood down from the front bench, didn't you, in unhappiness at Jeremy Corbyn. So you can't say that this is set in stone now. We're in a very shifting situation. Labour up at the moment, perhaps, but could very quickly fall.
We're living through, it, as I said earlier, a defining moment in our history. And it's not just what Brexit confronts us. It's what kind of country that we become. And recently, for example, I was at the launch of the IPPR Commission. Very interesting. That analysis, which says that there's been great changes in our history, depression, war, and then the social democratic settlement, the oil crisis of the 70s, and then a generation of Reaganomics. And now what we're seeing, not just in this country, but in America and elsewhere, is a politics of discontent. And in this country, it's manifesting.
Well, you were discontented with your own leader, weren't you, for a
while? I was critical of the conduct of the European referendum. But I tell you what, the way that our party has come together, and I have to say Jeremy has demonstrated his ability to lead and inspire, is nothing short of first class.
All right, Stephen?
The way the Labour Party came together at this conference, I mean, it was like some extreme religious revival, like almost like a cult. Come on, and that is not a sound basis on which to form a government to lead the country.
It's coming together around a radical vision for the transformation of our country. Because, Stephen, earlier on, reference was made to the G7. We're at the bottom of the league table. Our country is going backwards. It needs fundamental change.
Where I think you are onto something is I think there is a major battle of ideas going on. And I think one of the keys to my party's success in the future and the success long-term of a Conservative government is to win that battle of ideas.
Well,
so this isn't just about reshuffling personalities at the top of the government. It's actually about showing that we can regain a sense of idealism on the centre-right. And in the same way that, you know, I'll grant that Jeremy Corbyn has injected that element of idealism on the left, which Ed Miliband could never do.
Yes.
We've got to rise to that challenge on my side of the political divide and show that there's something worth fighting for.
But you won't do that with Theresa May and Boris Johnson.
Let me bring Jim Watson in at this point, because obviously there are some domestic policies to discuss as well, which will come up this week, like discussion of an energy price cap. That's going to be a big deal announced this week by Theresa May, isn't it?
Well, actually, you know, many listeners might not have noticed she actually did announce it during her speech, but unfortunately it was slightly overshadowed. The exact details of how it's going to work were somewhat vague in the post-briefing, post-speech briefing from her team. But essentially, legislation we brought forward on some level requiring a price cap, and but Ofgem, the regulator, will be given a chance to find out if it can do a better solution first. So, and I'll be honest, at this point, her spokesperson left the room saying, we've got a train to catch back to London. So I haven't managed to get that much more out of them since.
A timid, confused measure. The contrast with what we said 4 years ago and again in the general election campaign of actually putting a cap on prices, freezing them and then sorting out the energy market. This is a damp squib.
Stephen, something that you called for. Do you think it goes as far as you wanted it to?
So Jack is wrong, actually. What we're talking about at conference and what Labour has been talking about in the most recent manifesto actually isn't the same as what Ed Miliband talked about. A freeze is not the same thing as a cap. So it's important to kind of understand some of the essential differences. Look, this problem that we face with the energy markets, this is something entirely of the creation of the big energy companies themselves. They are entirely at fault in this, and we don't have enough transparency in the market. Two-thirds of consumers are being ripped off to around about £150 worth a year on their bills, and basically the government's run out of patience.
All right, well, that's an announcement happening this week. Something that came up during the conference was reflecting on universal credit. Now, there had been calls before the conference for the rollout nationally to be paused. John Major has said that universal credit is, although theoretically impeccable, it's operationally messy, socially unfair and unforgiving. Kirsty, your thoughts on universal credit, because I know that you've spoken about this quite recently.
I think it's clear that the rollout has not been overwhelmingly positive. The number of cases that I'm seeing come through the door of people whose benefit is... because there's a lag when you get the universal credit, it's a major problem. So housing associations, for example, are seeing massive increases in their rent arrears just because of this lag. So we're seeing increases in numbers of people going to food banks, for example, because of this lag in the timescale. So I think there's a major issue around that. The other issue around universal credit is the fact that people are getting a far different amount of money to the amount of money that they got previously. So actually it's a major hit on people. So this has been overwhelmingly negative, the experience of my constituents and the experience of a huge number of people. And the government needs to halt the rollout right now so that we can look at, you know, how this can be done better.
And is it administered differently in Scotland?
We're looking at having differences about things like the frequency of the payments, for example, and the way that landlords are paid as well, in order to get through those kind of two biggest issues that are coming through our doors.
Well, David Gawke did announce, didn't he, Stephen Crabb, that there wouldn't be a pause, but there would be some sort of rethink on the way that advance payments are made. Now, you're a former work and pension secretary. You know the difficulties there have been with this. I mean, why not have a pause? Just think it through properly, get it sorted, and then restart. Would that be a good idea in your view, having seen it from the inside?
So the reason that we're not pausing the rollout, actually, and Kirsty is wrong, all of the early evidence shows that overwhelmingly it does have a positive effect. It breaks down barriers that the old welfare system built in that actively discouraged people from moving off benefits into work or trapped them in this horrible 16-hour rule. Now, Kirsty is right. There is an issue about that lag, and that's something that we've addressed. There are other operational issues as well, but I don't think John Major is actually right that all of the operational aspect of the policy is flawed.
Socially unfair and unforgiving.
Yeah, so one of the ways that we're rolling this out is by, you know, to use a horrible civil service phrase, test and learn. We're doing it in a very, very careful, staged way. Lessons are being learned on the way. But look, there's a reason that no one questions the design of the fundamental design of the policy. It's because it does things that the old welfare system didn't do. It encourages people back into work, which is one of the reasons why we have a record employment level in this country, Jack.
But it's not working. There have been major problems in terms of the introduction. All the evidence is that those problems will take some considerable time to sort out. If you plough ahead regardless, the consequences will be when it's rolled out in Birmingham in December, believe you me, what we will see is tens of thousands of people suffering as a consequence.
Well, no one wants to see anybody suffering. Most people aren't falling into rent arrears. Where they are, it's important to understand the reasons why that is the case. There's also an issue around direct payment of the benefit to the recipient rather than what previously happened, where the benefit went direct to the landlord.
Why not pause, Stephen? Why not pause to get it sorted? Why go ahead regardless? Why not say... this is complex, it will take time, pause for 6 months, sort it, and then continue the rollout. Why not pause?
Because if you look at the evidence from the early cohorts of recipients where it has been rolled out, overwhelmingly, and I'm not saying that it's been free of problems, I'm not saying that at all, but overwhelmingly, the evidence is very positive. When I was at DWP and I toured the country visiting job centres, some of the most enthusiastic people I met in the whole organisation of DWP in favour of universal credit were the work coaches themselves, because they work at the front line and they can see the benefits of it.
It may well come up in further discussion as the next few weeks unfold. Now, Jim, run us through this week, starting with tomorrow, because looking ahead, it's a big day for Theresa May. Yes, about Brexit.
Yeah, we're Parliament is back. We've had the 3 week recess for the party conferences. The Lib Dems also had one, but we'll skirt over that for the moment. And so we've got to come back, and the Prime Minister is going to give an update on her big European speech in Florence, which is the other week, believe it or not, before all of this happened. So she'll address Parliament and give an update on that. And so her main thing there is to say everything is on track, everything is fine. Now, of course, the problem is, unfortunately, in Brussels, they do have access to the British media. So they've been reading what she's been up to and how the power is shifting, perhaps, within the party and what Boris Johnson has been up to. So that is going to play into all of that. We've then also got and this is something really interesting on a domestic policy agenda, it's the racial disparity audit.
That's on Tuesday, isn't it?
And that's going to be very bold. By all accounts, you know, the pre-briefing is that it's going to show stark differences between people of different ethnicities and even between ethnicities on where they live in the country. And that's something Theresa May's commissioned. It was something she set out at the very start of her leadership. But I'm intrigued to see how the country responds to that, really, because it is potentially something that Labour could make a lot out of. If it shows enormous disparity, it could be something that Jeremy Corbyn seizes on as an example of the system being broken, whereas she hopes to make it into something saying, look, this is us acknowledging a problem, this is us wanting to understand how the state can do things better, understand why education is failing some people, and what can we do about it.
And a Cabinet Office source has described the findings as pretty explosive. So we'll see. We've seen some of the data already, haven't we? But we're going to see the full audit on Tuesday. Come Wednesday, a big day in Parliament.
Yes, it's going to be a lot of fun and games. First Prime Minister's questions after the last few weeks is Jeremy Corbyn will have a lot of material. I'm sure Theresa May's aides will be sitting there trying to think of a lot of witty rebuttals as fast as they can right this moment.
And the 1922 Committee of Backbench MPs will meet as well, and we're told that they'll discuss a certain Mr. Johnson, Foreign Secretary.
Yeah, so Boris Johnson's name was repeatedly brought up at the Conservative Party conference, not normally in the most favourable terms by either activists or MPs when you got a drink down them in the bars. There was not a lot of love. But I'm interested to know, Stephen has been presumably on the WhatsApp groups, which seems to be running the government nowadays. and that seems to be basically where power resides now. If you've got the WhatsApp group of Tory MPs behind you, it seems that you're all right. And if you don't, then something's up.
Yeah, well, I am on the WhatsApp group, but I'm not going to talk about what's said on it. You can read it on the front page of the Daily Mail on Sunday.
We saw some of the comments on the Daily Mail. Right, now, the other issue, of course, the big issue, and we're talking about party conference speeches, is Nicola Sturgeon on Tuesday. Now, Jim, tell us what to expect, and then we'll hear from Kirsty.
Well, I'm sure Kirsty might disagree with this, but as far as I can see, Nicola Sturgeon's challenge is to talk enough about independence to keep the SNP's activists happy and on side, but without going too far as to scare away the voters now that the SNP are in a slightly more precarious electoral position. There's also the interesting issue of Catalonia and how she manages that and whether she addresses that, because for a lot of SNP activists, that's a big issue. But there's also the perception of if you start supporting breakaway states and unconstitutional referendums, then you end up in a problematic place if you're the leader of a devolved government.
Well, Kirsty, what is? Do you have a party line on Catalonia? Because, as Jim says, it's a tricky problem for you, isn't it?
I think we've been pretty clear on Catalonia. So we've at length criticised the actions and the violence that took place, particularly on the day of the referendum. I think the police violence was horrendous, and, you know, scenes of people being pulled by their hair and things. I think that was really grim. And we have been very clear that that's unacceptable. What we've said is, you know, people should have the right to vote. they should have the right to determine the future of their country. And we were very clear about that. I think now going forward, we need to make sure that people are actually getting around the table and that there is some level of dialogue. Things have clearly gone too far in terms of the situation between the two factions, if you like. And some level of constructive dialogue is what's needed in order to rescue this situation. I think there is a responsibility from the international community and actually from, you know, governments like the UK government to encourage that dialogue to take place. And I think that's what the Scottish Government and the SNP are doing.
And Kirsty, obviously the independence referendum, it's been put on hold, Nicola Sturgeon says, until she can see a clearer sign of what's happened with the Brexit deal. Are we going to get any signs of a date or an indication of when it might be, or indeed whether one will be ruled out?
I think we need to be clearer about what the terms of Brexit are going to be. As yet, the UK government don't even appear to be clear on this, so we're certainly not yet. And we've been clear that we would like to give the people of Scotland a choice, and that's still where we are.
All right. Well, look, we'll be following that speech, obviously, on Tuesday when it happens. Let's look ahead now to a very big deal for Parliament, as we've been discussing, plenty on the agenda to keep MPs busy as they return to Parliament this week. But there is this other controversial subject requiring urgent attention, the state of the Palace of Westminster itself. Much of the building, so familiar to us all, was created after a devastating fire in 1834, and it was substantially renovated after the Second World War. Well, now it's due for another overhaul. But should MPs and peers ship out completely to make way for the builders? And how much will the vast restoration project end up costing? Our reporter Mark Lobel has taken a tour.
Let me just lift you out of the pen, everybody. So welcome, everybody. I know you've come from all over the world. We have not only American visitors here, but people from Australia, Brazil, and even some British nationals.
With politicians away for party conference season these past few weeks, as is custom during recess, Parliament opened its doors for tour groups.
My name is Roz, and I'm your guide today, and I'm going to take you round the Palace of Westminster. Now, we're going to start off here in Westminster Hall, which is one of the most beautiful rooms in the palace, and it's also one of the oldest. We're lucky enough to have this building here today because during the Second World War, the Palace of Westminster was bombed.
Its medieval and Victorian Gothic architecture makes this one of the most recognisable and most photographed buildings in the UK. But on their way in, these visitors will have noticed that large parts of it are swathed in scaffolding, because in places the cradle of British democracy is crumbling away.
Can you just put a high-vis jacket on, because we're going to be going up on the roof. So if I can just pass you a hat to put on as well.
Thank you. Will do.
And then we're head on up.
To see what is causing so much concern, I went on a much less enticing tour of the building with two officials masterminding what's called the Restoration and Renewal Programme. They have already taken dozens of MPs and peers around the bowels of Parliament. Here is Design Director Andy Piper and first, the Programme Director, Tom Healy.
We had sewage literally sort of pouring out of the ceiling and pooling on the floor. The building at the moment is deteriorating more quickly than we can repair it under current conditions. To give you an idea, by 2020, about 40% of the essential mechanical and electrical systems that serve the building will be at very high risk of failure.
So there's a whole labyrinth of smoke and ventilation systems that run throughout the palace, and we've broken those out.
This is the kind of space where the fire can spread.
So this is one of the 117 plant rooms that we have refurbished.
And it's during that refurbishment works that the roof actually caught a light.
So in trying to protect it from fires, it caught fire?
Yeah, so some of the heaviest risks you get is when all these contractors come on site.
Last year, a cross-party committee of MPs and peers considered the best way to address all these problems. They concluded everyone should move out for a period of around 6 years to allow a full-scale restoration of Parliament at a cost of £3.5 to £3.9 billion. The former leader of the House of Lords, Baroness Stoll, was on the committee that recommended this option, known as the full decant.
The patch and mend approach is no longer sustainable. And now that ongoing programme of works, the sort of fourth bridge approach, if you like, I mean, that is not viable because the risk involved of following that course is so great, because any moment there could be a massive systems failure. To us as a committee, our view was we want to preserve, we believe it is Parliament's responsibility to preserve this public building at the lowest cost and the lowest risk. And our clear conclusion was the best way to do that was for us to leave temporarily, but to leave in one go and then to return to Parliament afterwards.
But the decant option is controversial. One staunch campaigner against a full decant is the Conservative MP Sir Edward Lee, who employed his own architect last year to draw up alternative plans.
I don't believe that you have to move out of the building to deal with a fire risk. Once we move out, I believe that the bill will rise exponentially. I think this will be a feeding feast for architects, consultants and builders, with incalculable damage to the local tourist industry, to the millions of people who visit this building and admire it and want to use it as a continuing attraction. This is the centre of our national life. It's a symbol of the nation. Don't close it down for 10 years.
It means something. It really does. These are the chimes of freedom, and they've got to be respected. We've got to keep them bonging.
Over the summer, some MPs held a vigil for the last chimes of Big Ben, before it was silenced for repairs to the Elizabeth Tower. As if that wasn't controversial enough, it has since emerged that the cost of those works has doubled to £60 million. So are the estimates for the full refurbishment any more accurate? I asked Parliament's Restoration and Renewal Programme Director, Tom Healy, about those figures.
I certainly wouldn't like to put my hand on my heart and say these are what the actual costs will be. They're not budgets, they're not costs, and they were never intended to be.
So do we have any indication of what the costs might be for the works?
We are just at the very early stages of commencing the design process. It's too early to say what the final budget will be, but I think it's fair to say that the order of magnitude that Deloitte suggested, which was in the billions of pounds, is probably correct.
There is widespread agreement, though, that the longer it takes to make a decision, the higher the costs are likely to be, with so much planning ahead. Here's the shadow leader of the House, Valerie Vaz.
It's really important that the government get a grip of this, which they have failed to do so far, particularly as the report has been published for some time now. And for me, there is a very simple motion that can be put to the House.
Valerie Vaz thinks an Olympic-style setup is needed, with a delivery authority of experts appointed to oversee the work, which would be accountable to a cross-party committee of MPs and peers.
Certainly, there has to be some up-to-date information on how much it's all going to cost and what actually needs to be done. So I think the scoping exercise needs to be done first, and that will inform the debate. And the two should definitely, in my view, happen before Christmas.
The government plans a free vote in both houses on the way ahead, but is yet to decide a motion or date for the debate, although it is expected to be held this autumn. Sir Edward Lee says that if the government does choose to press ahead with a full decant option, he will oppose it.
We will propose an amendment, and I think we've... I'm not saying we're going to win, but I think we can give the government a very good run for the money. The Conservative Parliamentary Party is overwhelmingly in favour of maintaining a footprint in this building. We've got support in the Labour Party.
How many people in the Labour Party that you know of?
Without trying very hard, we had at least 30 or 40 before the election, and I would hope we'd, if we went round now seriously, would be up to 60 or 70. That's for starters.
The SNP?
I think the SNP will vote against a full decant. They view it as a waste of money.
Those in favour of a decant, including the parliamentary authorities, insist repairs are too technically challenging without one. Indeed, preparations for a move in 6 years' time are underway, with plans already drawn up for temporary chambers for the Lords and the Commons in other locations around Westminster. But until Parliament makes its decision, this is yet another passionate contest between Leavers and Remainers.
Mark Lobel reporting. So, Kirsty Blackman, how will you vote?
It's too much money. I can't believe that we're looking at spending, you know, billions of pounds on refurbishing a building so that we can work in it. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that we're even considering doing this. And I think...
Well, doing what? I mean, what do you think should happen? No work at all?
I think... Well, we've previously talked about, you know, looking at options that are much more cost effective, looking at doing public consultations on options like that, looking at, you know, maybe moving Parliament to somewhere else. Any suggestion that what we should do, Edward Lee's suggestions about making sure that we retain a footprint in the building, I just don't understand why.
So can I just get this clear? Are you saying that you think it would be the most cost effective for everyone to move out of the building, move elsewhere while the work's done?
I think we should. I'm not sure that we should ever move back, frankly, because I don't know why. I don't know that we should be spending that much money in order to get the building up to standard for us to work there.
All right, Jack and Stephen, your views. Jack.
Well, the Mother of Parliaments is a great historic building. It requires to be brought up to standard. It must be done in a cost-effective way. I have an open mind in terms of the options in front of us. All I would add is one very important point. And that is who carries out the work. It's, to be frank, shameful that McAlpines have got the contract for Big Ben, despite the fact that they've got a long track record of blacklisting workers. And certainly one of the things I will be arguing is that when a decision is made eventually and the work is done, we need to ensure that it's done by reputable firms that do not discriminate against people because they're trade unionists.
And if the work is carried out by a firm that you're happy with, would you vote for a full decant, as it's called, or a partial decant? Because the full decant is the most cost-effective way of getting it done.
I genuinely have an open mind. I mean, you can have a combination, or alternatively, you can relocate to somewhere close to Westminster, which actually is necessary in terms of the day-to-day functioning of Parliament, the interrelationship with government. I think Val Vaz is right when she says that the government needs to get a grip of this. It's been drifting for far too long. And as a consequence, by the way, the costs keep escalating.
So, Stephen, what about you? What do you think will be the timescale for a vote? Because it keeps being put off, doesn't it? And I suppose, is that because no government wants to go to the public in the current climate and say, will you please allow us to spend billions of pounds updating our own offices?
So I think there really is a challenging discussion to have with the public about the costs involved. And by the way, I don't think anyone really believes the costs will stay around £3.5 to £4 billion for the cheapest option. Everyone expects it to cost more than that. But can I just come back to what Kirsty was saying? Because I thought it was actually really quite sad to hear her basically say that she'd be happy to see that wonderful building that is admired the world over just crumbling into the Thames. It needs a serious work. Whatever you're going to do with it, it needs some serious work that costs a lot of money to safeguard it for the future. And I don't think any sensible person would want to see it just crumble and disappear and decay out of our national life. So, look, I'm open-minded like Jack is. I want to see more evidence of the costs. I think we need to be upfront with the public about the scale of this and the costs of it. And if the most straightforward, quickest, cheapest thing to do is the full decant, then, you know, I'm not going to be swayed by emotion. I'll vote in favour of that.
Because the sticking plaster approach is costing hundreds of thousands of pounds just keeping the place going.
Yes, there's a small army in there at the moment, you know, working in the bowels of the House of Commons, seeking to keep Parliament going. I think the sooner we make a decision on this, the better. But forgive me if I stress once again, I want to see reputable companies that treat workers fairly doing the work on renovating. And I think Stephen's right. We both have the same view on this. It's a piece of our democratic history. The idea that you allow the House of Commons ultimately to decay, or you move out, you leave it behind us, it becomes history, I think would be absolutely wrong.
Well, Kirsty, you're outnumbered here.
I know, I don't want to see the building crumble. However, I think the standard it would have to be brought up to for people to work in it daily is going to be a different standard to it being a tourist attraction, and would presumably cost less to have it as a tourist attraction than a place of work.
Jim?
Well, here's a proposal then. We sell the building, it becomes the House of Commons Hotel, and we get a nice brownfield site in central Manchester, move everyone up there, and start again with everyone up there.
I know. Are you Manchester?
No, but are you in? Are we in? Can we sign you up?
No.
I know there are several MPs who agree with you.
Manchester would half my commute.
Well, there you are.
There we are. Maybe that's the way forward. Anyway, let's move along and talk about a tale of press barons and shadowy spooks all conniving with the White House to bring down a left-wing Labour government.
My mother telephoned today. She told me that Daddy had told her that Uncle Percy made a secret visit to the President while he was in Washington.
What?
Sir Percy Brown, Cabinet Office.
If it was a secret visit, how come your father knew about it?
There are no secrets between old Etonians.
Jesus Christ. This is high treason.
No, just treason. It's only high treason if you're at war.
It is fiction so far. It's the plot for Channel 4's political drama A Very British Coup. The TV series was based on the novel by the former Labour MP Chris Mullin. It's a book which has come back into vogue with the election of Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader. Our reporter John Beasley asked Chris Mullin whether the idea of the establishment mobilising to overthrow a leftist prime minister was ever a realistic prospect.
Well, it was a fairly realistic prospect. If you recall, because the novel was published in 1982, and there was then a prospect that Tony Benn might lead the Labour Party and the establishment were working themselves up into a bit of a frenzy over that. And also, and one has to pinch oneself to recall, Mrs. Thatcher wasn't popular at that time. It was before the Falklands War transformed her election prospects, and the polls put Labour ahead at that time.
Well, we have a clip from the election night speech of your fictional Prime Minister, Harry Perkins. He's played in the original Channel 4 dramatisation by Ray McAnally. And here he is on election night responding to newspapers who've all called him a simple-minded fool.
If it's foolish to want to spend money on milk for children and care for elderly rather than on even more sophisticated bombs for military, then I am a fool. If it is simple-minded and foolish to feel revulsion at the fact that millions of men, women and children are forced to live in hell so that a tiny bunch of fat cats can eat the cream, then yes, I plead guilty. I hold up my hands and I confess I am a simple-minded fool.
I mean, in substance, if not in tone, that does sound quite like Jeremy Corbyn. He's kind of revitalised your premise, hasn't he, in some ways?
Well, it certainly has rung a number of bells since Jeremy was elected. There have been two reprints of the novel since then, and a third one is coming in November. It is often mentioned as the novel that predicted the rise of Corbyn, though whether that's quite true or not, I don't know.
We have seen an election, of course, in which the press did throw the kitchen sink at Corbyn in much the same way as happens in your book to Harry Perkins, and he survived. It didn't seem to have much effect.
That was a most interesting phenomena. It was like water off a duck's back. I think if there's any message from the outcome of the last election, it is that pushing those buttons doesn't really work anymore. Of course, that won't stop them, I think, behaving badly. In fact, they'll become hysterical, I think, at the prospect of a Corbyn government. There are other issues too. There's the question of whether the security services and MI6 would interfere in politics, as they obviously did in the 70s and 80s. My feeling is they wouldn't. MI5 is totally reformed.
So if Jeremy Corbyn were ever to lead a Labour government, where do you think that the main opposition would come from?
Well, a large chunk of the media, without any doubt. The Tory party, but that's their job. One assumes the Americans wouldn't be too keen on him either, but then we're not too keen on the American administration these days, are we?
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, would the Americans care that much? In the 1980s, obviously, they had bases to protect in Britain. We were in the middle of the Cold War. Now, of course, the Cold War's over. Practically all the American bases have gone. Are they really that bothered about the political complexion of a British government?
They might not be. I don't think they'd be all that happy. When the novel was first published in 1982, we used to sell it, the hardback, through an advert at the back of Tribune, the little socialist newspaper that I later edited. And the first cheque for £6.95 that came in came from the American embassy. And so we packed it up and sent it off and waited to see what would happen. And the next thing that happened was that I received an invitation to lunch with the minister, the most important man after the ambassador, at the embassy. And I said to him, "Why are you bothering with a minnow like me?" He said, "Well, I reckon you're among the top 1,000 opinion formers in the country." So I said, "Well, I must be about number 999. He said, "The other 999 have been here too."
That does make you think, doesn't it? Do you have any advice for Jeremy Corbyn should he find himself being thwarted at every turn?
Providing he addresses the nation and not the party, and providing he does, as he has been doing, highlight things that are clearly quite popular: public house building, student fees, the misbehaviour of the utility companies. These are all issues that I think ring bells with the public. The one area I think he'd be wise to leave on the back burner is nuclear weapons. Politically, I think only the Tories could get rid of them. If the Tories got up one morning and announced they were going to phase out Trident, there'd be a bit of a fuss and then it would all blow over. But I think we have learned from experience that mass hysteria would be organised if a Labour government tried that.
The unmistakable voice of Chris Mullin. Jack Jeremy, does that sort of thing worry you still, the pushback from the security services, the press barons, the Americans, who Chris Mullin imagined would try to bring down his fictional Labour Prime Minister?
I remember that period of the 70s and 80s very well. Chris is an old friend, and he, like I, was the subject of interest on the part of the security services. There was a particular set of circumstances, the coming together of America, of the Cold War, of paranoia about the left, of running together people who were active trade unionists with somehow that they were subversives. But things have moved on from then. But having said that, we would be, we will be, when we are elected, a radical reforming government determined fundamentally to transform the country. That will run into opposition. Of that, there is absolutely no doubt.
Chris
is right, because first of all, on the media, is to be frank, the right-wing media barons no longer have the sway that they once did. I read a very interesting piece recently, Jim, that you wrote, which is absolutely right, that straight journalists like Jim on the one hand and social media on the other hand mean that the Mail, the Express and the Sun no longer have the purchase that they once did. I think Chris is right when he then says that what's crucial is popular opinion, that you carry the country with you. We are enthusing the country and we will enthuse the country. But also in our programme, what we intend to do in terms of, for example, investing in and rebuilding the economy. That will build a broad alliance of interest, including with employers.
Thank
we'll
you
be pro-worker and pro-employer.
I am enjoying listening to Bracken enormously. Of course, the real establishment that tried its hardest to stop Jeremy Corbyn was, of course, the old Labour Party establishment, of which Jack Jeremy was a key part.
Yes. Anyway, now then, Jim.
Right, we'll rattle through with what the papers are saying tomorrow as we try. We've tried to sum it up and we'll see how they're doing it. So the Times is leading on "The Ball's in Your Court," May tells EU leaders, which is her update to the House of Commons, in which she'll say, "We've gone as far as we're going to. We need to move on to the next stage in negotiations, even though we haven't quite finished the divorce bill yet."
And a quick word from you, Stephen, on what you think she should do. I mean, in your view, she needs to go much further, doesn't she, make things clearer?
Well, she needs to come out strong. I actually thought the Florence speech was a very good speech. I think that it does set a template for these next stages, this really sensitive next stage of the negotiations, which actually most sensible opinion, not just in the Tory ranks, but across the House, can unite around the need for a transition period, the need to, the positive signal that she sent about keeping our financial obligations, which actually was quite well received by EU leaders. So she is right. The ball is in the EU's court. There's a lot more work to go, though, a lot more work to do. But we really are starting to get into the really sensitive, critical moment now.
Jim.
And The Guardian has Tory Brexiteers turn their fire on Treasury, which is Bernard Jenkin briefing against Philip Hammond. And there's quite a lot of anti-Philip Hammond briefing in the papers tomorrow. The Telegraph is warning, "Sack Boris and he will refuse to go," May warned, which I don't think is exactly how it works when you're given a P4. Well, actually, we do know what happens when you're given a P45. You find yourself on stage at Conservative Party conference plotting through a speech. But there you go. An ally of Mr Johnson, who sounds suspiciously like Boris Johnson, says trying to sack him would go down like a bucket of cold sick. So I can't imagine who's briefing the Telegraph there.
Well, and I mean, we've heard plenty of people saying it's better to have him inside the tent than outside the tent, but I don't know how long that position will stand.
The Daily Express goes with May warns EU, "The ball's in your court." As always, the Daily Express, it's taking a certain line, which is that it's all the EU's problem and they've got to sort it out rather than us. The National, which is the pro-independence Scottish newspaper, has Nicola Sturgeon as picture under the headline, "The case for India has never been greater," which is interesting given the state of Scottish politics, the fact the SNP lost seats at the last election. But they're saying she won't rule out a second India referendum before the next set of elections in Scotland.
And the Telegraph's got that same. SNP reaffirms pledge for second vote on Scottish independence. So, Kirsty, you like that headline, do you?
I think in terms of the case for independence, given what's happening with Brexit, given the economic calamity that the Tories are creating and have got their head in the sands about. I think she's right, you know, the case for independence has never been greater. I think we could do a much better job with our economy than the Tories are.
Anything else, Jim, that's come up? One more final headline.
Well, we've got the Scotsman saying that Scotland won't follow the unrest in Catalonia, and I must say that there's some excellent stuff on BuzzFeed.com, including an investigation into sexual violence at universities.
Oh, well, yes. Well, and where can people find that if they don't know how to find it?
BuzzFeed.com, we cover the whole gamut of everything from entertainment to news to politics to everything, and go and check it out if you haven't already.
Good advert for you. Thank you very much. We have to call it to a close there. But Jim Waterson, thanks for joining us this week. Stephen Crabb, Jack Dromey, Kirsty Blackman in Glasgow, getting ready for that speech this week. And Nicola Sturgeon's speech, of course, on Tuesday. Thanks all for joining us. We will be back at the usual time next week. Until then, from all of us here at the Westminster Hour, have a very good night.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.